Lunch with Leon.
So welcome to another edition of Lunch with Leon. Now look, things are just changing a little bit here at Lunch with Leon. This podcast is now produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Of course you know them, nearly 300 editions of this famous fortnightly publication that tells us all about everything that's going on in the passenger transport world. So I'm really excited to be working with the passenger transport team. I hope you've got a subscription. Indeed, you really should have, because it's a great way to keep up with all of the news, either in print or, of course, online. So my guest today is Willie Patterson. He's the chief executive of Asset Alliance Group. He's got a huge book on truck and an increasing amount on bus and coach. He has two great passions in life. Commercial asset finance is one and motorsport is the other. So we had a great time talking together. But we started out because I had read the Asset Alliance Industry Report. It was really very interesting that 84% of the people that Asset Alliance spoke to had not yet started on their journey towards zero emission. And I asked Willie what he thought about that.
You might think that's quite strange, but in a lot of ways it's quite typical. A lot of the UK fleets are quite spread in that you still have a number of very long established, way family owned businesses that have either evolved into larger operators or are still the same size fleets they are. And over the years in our industry, we've seen significant change. We've seen the switch into Euro 3 and then forwards into where we are now, Euro 6 and preparing for Euro 7. We've seen the digitalization of tachographs. You know, we've seen a whole host of changes over the years. And, a lot of operators tend to want to wait till the last minute, till they're absolutely certain what's going to go, until that little bit of price inflation that tends to happen with new technology settles down. And I think there's a lot of that going on, but there's also an awful lot of uncertainty. If you speak to the manufacturers, they've all got a slightly different story to tell. And then you've got I would use the word propaganda, but I'm not sure that's correct. You've got the story and the hype coming from the legislative narrative that's saying vehicles have no more combustion engines by, 2030, 2040, depending on what type of vehicle you're looking at. You know, the switch is definitely electric, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got all the infrastructure woes that we're hearing in the market saying, well, there's no way we can switch to electric. The infrastructure's not there for hydrogen, da-da, da-da, da-da. And I think we are still very much in that no man's land in the middle. And there is no firm story coming out that says the future is X, Y, or Z. And I think that's the problem. And we were certainly sitting back thinking that ourselves. And then towards the end of last year, I and some of my team suddenly woke up and thought, actually, we're behind the eight ball here. The development of the hydrogen technology, be it fuel cell or combustion engine, and the rapid development and the electrical product, not necessarily the infrastructure, but the product seems to be moving a lot quicker than what we'd initially thought. So we as one decided it was time we jumped in the deep end a little bit and started taking some moves forward. We have customers now specifically asking for electric product at certain weight categories. So we felt it was time that we had enough scale and certainty in our business that we could take a little bit of a leap forward. And that's what we have done. And I think that's what's happening in the market. I think through 2023, we will see that number drop significantly. I don't think it will drop below 50% yet, but I definitely think it will come down from the 80-odd% that we're seeing currently.
Sure. So I couldn't make, and I don't want you to give away any commercial secrets, of course, but I couldn't work out in my mind, if I was in your position, whether I'd be expecting a proportion of the market to stick with internal combustion engine right up until the wire and then get another 5-10 years life, if you like, out of the ICE product, which would mean, wouldn't it, that residuals would be strong in that sector. Mm-hmm. Or whether people are going to dive for the new technology and that, in fact, would make the residuals on ICE much lower. And that feels, from what you're saying, that that's something of a gamble at this point, because we're still not quite sure which
which way that's going, whether ICE residuals are going to collapse in the run up to 2030 or whenever, or whether they're going to be strong.
Yeah, I've got to be honest and say I don't know. I would hope the demand for the last of the ICE Euro 6 or diesel engine contains, because I've got 5,000 diesel engines in my truck fleet and another 2,000 in the bus fleet. You know, so I'm kind of hoping that there is a bit of a tailwind in that, and that we do end up still managing to exit it reasonably securely. I think it will happen, because I think there still are a number of traditional operators out there who own their vehicles on either buying them or HP and run them down to a low value. And I think that will happen. We certainly saw that happen before with the previous category changes, Euro 3, analog tachographs, et cetera, et cetera. We certainly saw that stretching out, and actually the residual values went up a little bit. I also think, and there are a number of operators won't have an option. They'll have very, very traditional businesses that don't necessarily get caught out with, you know, LEZs and new LEZs, and therefore they can keep operating trucks a little bit longer under the operation. And frankly, they've not been able to pass on the necessary price increases that an electric truck currently needs. You know, you're looking, as near as damn it, double the price for an electric truck relative to a diesel at the moment. And whilst the manufacturers are very much trying hard to cushion that a little bit and come up with ways to make that transition, there is no doubt that they are more expensive to operate. No question about it at the moment.
That's really interesting. One or two of the coach people told me that when they've invested in zero emission coaches, they've been able to get higher prices from hirers. And the sorts of hirers these people would be effectively companies, corporate customers who've got their own CSR agenda. And therefore they're hiring zero emission vehicles as part of playing their part in the green revolution and so on, and are paying higher prices. But from what you just said, that doesn't seem to be typical in truck.
So the coach industry has a much more, and the bus industry has a much more diverse application than maybe commercial vehicles. So you've got holidays, corporate tours, stage fairs, schools work, and the corporate work. We have customers also in the commercial vehicle sector that are similar. And you know, without naming names, I can name certain fleets that have a very much green credential, and certain ones, manufacturers from Scandinavia that make furniture that are absolutely aligned to the green flag, and that's great and it's good. And we've got customers that big fleet operators that are saying we have to be seen to be doing this, but not everybody's in that capability zone, you know.
No, for sure.
And so the margins in some of the operations just aren't there at the moment. And there's a willingness to want to do it. There's a need, because we don't have an option. The legislation states we are going down that route, and we have to get there. But at the moment, I still believe that the whole cost scenario, the capability is an unknown zone. And unless for the either very, very large logistics businesses or the very focused own account operators who have specific business needs and margins and business models that can go with it, I think it's early days.
Well, it's funny. In fact, I wasn't going to mention it, but you did. One of the things from your report that rooted me to the floor was the pre-tax profit margins of some of the operators, because those of us that come from passenger generally tend to think that passenger is on really miserable margins, but the very much bigger logistics market is doing okay, because let's face it, there's tens of thousands of trucks licensed and running. But your report shows that a number of famous names that we all know and love are working on wafer thin margins. And I know you can always excuse some of this, you know, Brexit, COVID, whatever you want. And I know that statutory accounts aren't always an accurate picture of how the business is really performing, but even that might explain one or two. But there's a whole raft of people here working below 4%, which in inflationary terms, with inflation rates with interest rates at sort of 5 and 6%, my goodness me, this is awful.
Yeah, absolutely. The I'm very careful what the terms to use between haulage and logistics, because they are general haulage and it's very different sectors.
Uh-huh.
But the more general traditional haulage market, the hire and reward type business, has traditionally operated in the 2 to 6% net margin zone. And the only way to really improve that is to try and specialise, try and contractualise some of the business and get fuel escalators, etc. on there. But you're very much in a hugely competitive market. And these guys survive by operating a tight business and operating their business in such a way where they can contain cost. The bigger operators, we've seen a huge change in the last 5 years with aggregation and consolidation. There are 10, maybe 12 operators in the UK, very, very successful business that have been around a long, long time, have seen the changes in the market and are playing the aggregation and consolidation game very well. They're out there looking for the smaller family businesses that have good customer base, good operation, but perhaps are getting to the end of the family generation involved in the business, and they're acquiring them and growing them, integrating them into their network, and driving profitability into them and economies of scale. And I think that will continue.
Interesting. In fact, let me just take us off on a little diversion then, because it seems to me, as certainly we've seen in various sectors, the reduction in the number of visitors and people interested in trade shows and exhibitions, because it feels to me in some ways that deals that used to be done at these trade shows by family businesses, where the father runs the business, the mother runs the office, the eldest son is the chief engineer, and the daughter is in charge of sales. You know, they would go en masse as a family to shows and literally do deals on the stand. Whereas those are generationally, that's sort of coming to the end. And now the procurement process for large organizations is a very sophisticated and precise type of science. And as a result of which, these trade shows are not quite the attraction they used to be in the marketplace, because you might move a deal on a bit, but you're certainly not going to sign one off just as a result of a handshake like we used to do years ago. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would say it is. The big shows are all about the manufacturers and the suppliers showing their new products. They use it for product launches, but it's very much just an opportunity to meet your customers and show them that you are close to your industry and try and get a bit of time with them. And very much as a meet and greet and a thank you for the business. Very, very, very rarely now do you do meaningful business on the stands. You learn about, you get time to talk and learn about where the industry's going, what's happening. You know, very much now we get these forums on these shows where you can sit and listen to industry experts, and you can have a really good, useful and meaningful discussion about where the industry's going. And we pay quite a bit of focus to that. And we certainly work very closely with, the trade press to try and pick up all the data from that and learn from it and use it as a useful forum. But it's definitely not really there. We're not there to sell anything. We're there just to promote our brand and meet our customers, which is really important.
That is really interesting. That's sort of where I thought, as you know, we've lost our big bus and coach trade show at NEC Birmingham this year through lack of interest from the manufacturers. I think we know there were one or two other shows, CV show and so on, all of which are in various stages of, best way I can describe it is reviewing what they're supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to exist.
Lunch with Leon, in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Check out passengertransport.co.uk.
So the other thing in your report I was fascinated about, which is the factors to influence the change to alternative fuels. And a couple of things jumped out at me. One was that 22% of people either didn't know or couldn't specify it, which was interesting. But right at the top of it is the public refueling infrastructure. And I guess this is the nub of the problem for zero emission vehicles, isn't it? Is that if your vehicle doesn't, like a bus, come home every night and is likely to be stationed away, is likely to do long distance, may well be traveling internationally and so on, there's a great deal of uncertainty about the unevenness, certainly of the electric charging infrastructure and the complete absence of hydrogen infrastructure. Yeah. So not surprising that 55% here, the operators were saying that they didn't have confidence in public refueling infrastructure for their business. And is that what I couldn't work out in my mind is that the excuse why you didn't do it? Because I hear my friends say, you know, I'm not going to get an electric car because I don't know where I'm going to charge it. Sometimes people say that as to justify the fact they're carrying on with old technology, potentially in a causing emissions, or maybe it's real. And I don't know. How do you feel?
So in my opinion, and I'll caveat that because I don't have statistics to justify it, but I definitely think from a heavy commercial vehicle perspective, the infrastructure is non-existent at the moment. I don't think, you know, anything above 7.5 tons, really, maybe 18 tons, doesn't really suit a long distance application in terms of the battery technology, the ability to have, and the time required to recharge, coupled to driver's hours, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's non-existent at the moment. At the moment, last mile is working for certain customers. You know, it's you know, the trunkers are coming in to just outside the urban scenarios, and they're doing changeovers at RDCs, and last mile into ULZs are working fine with electric, and that's going to get significantly better very quickly. So we talked to all the manufacturers, and the battery technologies are developing rapidly in the vehicles. So much smaller batteries, much lighter batteries that can charge much quicker are very definitely on the up. The challenge that you've got is if you want to charge a battery for a heavy truck, and there are manufacturers that say we can do 40 tons and we can get 200-300 mile ranges. That's not enough. It needs to be 500-mile ranges to make up, you know, the trampers work. And at the moment, it's taking 12 to 24 hours to recharge these trucks meaningfully. That will improve dramatically, but that infrastructure is not there. My own personal view, hydrogen is the best opportunity in heavy truck at the moment. If we can develop the engine technology, then the ability to refuel a hydrogen truck is much faster. And I think that the ability to put up recharging stations or change existing recharging stations or refueling stations for hydrogen seems like a more easily achievable standard. And I think that's where we'll end up going. But it's changing at such a dimension at the moment that we just don't know.
No. So, and do you mean hydrogen as a fuel into a combustion engine, or hydrogen, not hydrogen creating electricity to drive an electric motor?
Yeah, no, I tend to think the hydrogen ICE option is the one that will levitate back. We've seen JCB and other majors developing good ICE hydrogen engines at the moment that are working in their plant. What we need now is one for the government to change the rules slightly that say ICE will work at a certain emissions ratio, which at the moment they've just categorically banned ICE engines. And then we need the fuel companies and the fuel suppliers to put in play an ability to get sufficient volumes of hydrogen into regional charge stations, refueling stations.
Well, I agree with you entirely. Hydrogen as a fuel, I think, has got great promise. And you've already mentioned the thing that will force it is the fact that for plant, it's certainly in certain inaccessible places in the world, hydrogen as a fuel is the only answer for a bulldozer in Africa or whatever. And I'm not surprised.
Maybe in the middle of nowhere in Australia.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Joe Bamford, you know, as you know, is a great evangelist for hydrogen. Generally, I know is pushing really very hard on this. I've got a slight concern. So I brought the first hydrogen buses into London in 2004.
Right.
And they told me then that the technology was just around the corner. So here we are 20 years later, and the hydrogen infrastructure is not there. Access, if I might say so, to green hydrogen is even more limited than just general hydrogen, because of the way of the world. Certainly on the hydrogen fuel cell, the cost and the miniaturization effect are just horrendous. So that leads you to hydrogen as a fuel. And I would love to believe that it's the answer. But what I'm seeing is that the battery technology is developing so fast that the sort of first mover advantage that battery electric has had, as their technology refines, their stuff, not only are they gaining ground and market share, as the technology improves and the range improves and the weight goes down and the battery the energy density improves, then the case for hydrogen gets progressively weaker. And so there's some places where we might have had hydrogen, we might not have. And so what will be left at the end of the day will be plant and equipment, especially in faraway, inaccessible places, and the longer distance international truck market, which I suspect is a slightly smaller market than they might have had if we got on with this a bit quicker.
Yeah, I think your point is very logical, Leon. The challenge you've got is the supply of electricity and the infrastructure for electricity. So we are seeing, a year ago, I thought, right, there's an opportunity here. We need to go and get in touch with and look at the supply of green hydrogen. We in part of our group, we have quite a big taxi business, specifically in London. And I think we've got around 6,000 taxis that we finance working in London. And I was approached by a business to say, we can switch all these to hydrogen and we can supply the hydrogen at a fixed price over 12 years. And I really liked that. I thought that's a great move, because if the cost of the vehicle is so much more expensive, and it was initially, it's not so bad now, then there's a real compelling opportunity here for me as the supplier, financier, maintainer, and residual risk taker what is £100,000 or a £300,000 product. There's a great opportunity for me to help that transition. So if I can go to a customer and say, right, you're running a Euro 6 truck and trailer right now, which we supply. We would like you to move into into a hydrogen or electric, double the price. And the way we can do it is we will give you your fuel at absolute fixed price for 10 years, right? That's achievable in green hydrogen. It's not at all achievable any other way, because the demand and supply argument would suggest that the higher the demand for electricity or hydrogen increases, therefore the price is going to increase, the price equilibrium point. Whereas if I can get enough regional green hydrogen by, somebody setting up a wind farm, adding a solar farm and a battery capability, then the price to the major cost in the hydrogen is the electricity for the production. Then we've got a great opportunity. We started looking at it and thinking, right, there's certain places that this will work, and we realize there are people very much at that already. That industry is very well developed and developing rapidly at the moment. And I therefore believe that hydrogen will be an option, and the limiting factor will be the supply of electricity to the electric market.
Yeah. Okay. No, I get that, because I think I understand there is enough electricity, but it's just not adequately distributed. So well, therefore,
I'm not sure I agree with you. We are hearing talk of power cuts and things like that, and it depends who you talk to. Talk to somebody in the power companies, and they'll say, "Well, we can supply enough electricity in an aggregated total, kilowatt hour basis." I'm not sure they can do it each and every hour, all the time, 24 hours a day. And then they've got the capacity of the pipes aren't big enough to get the electricity where it needs to be across the UK all the time, and you just wouldn't know who to believe. But at the moment, I'm tended to believe that there is an issue there in the supply of electricity. Whether it's the manufacturing of it or the distribution of it, I don't know.
No, that's interesting. Well, Graham Cooper from National Grid, before he left these shores to go and work somewhere warmer, sunnier, and under a different political arrangement, he used to make two points to me. One was there is a tremendous overlap between the distribution network and the trunk road and motorway network in this country. There's a lot of power near our major roads. But on the other side of that, the average motorway service area with charging infrastructure in place has the electrical demand of a town.
Yeah.
Because you're cooking, you're lighting, you're fueling, you're charging. Yeah. And actually, the motorway service areas, we always forget, don't we? We think of them just on the side of the motorway. But in fact, from behind the scenes, they're actually in quite remote places. By definition, that's the only place you could build a motorway service area, like in a series of fields. And therefore, the services, including the power and also the water and everything else, has all got to be grafted in. And you can't just add 30 charging stations for electric vehicles by plugging it in the wall, because it was never designed to have that. Exactly. That is exciting. And I suppose one of the reasons why we're in this business, of course, is that we're all in the game of trying to predict the future and align our businesses in such a way as to capture the upside, whatever it is, whenever it happens. I guess that's one of the reasons why we're in it. So I just want to raise something else with you, if I may. It's something else that comes out of your report. So apropos of nothing at all, I just came back. I was speaking at the Women in Rail conference in Kuala Lumpur. And I can't tell you how wonderful it is to have 550 young Muslim women all asking about how you get into highway engineering, traffic signals engineering, railway signaling engineering, rolling stock railway engineering, et cetera, and so on. It's extraordinary. So one of the things that jumped out of me on your report is a couple of vox pops from two senior women in the business. There's Leslie O'Brien, who's MD at Freightlink Europe, and Caroline Green, Chief Executive at Palletrack. Fantastic to see women in important positions in the whole trucking and logistics freight industry, isn't it? Is that something you're seeing more and more?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's not unusual, because I've grown up in and around the haulage industry. I have family connections that are, you know, been in the business for, you know, I think it must be 75 to 100 years now, and there are strong females in those businesses and always have been. So if you look at family-owned businesses, the tradition is the guy's out there running the trucks and the wife is running the office. And so I've been very, very used to dealing with really good, strong women in management positions in this sector pretty much for the 35 years that I've been involved in it. So I'm not at all surprised. I think what we are seeing now, though, is the changes in the boardroom of the bigger businesses. You know, businesses have been under great, great pressure for the last 10 years to diversify their board and for the right reasons, and in the last 5 years have started to really achieve it. You know, we are seeing really good, strong, professional women in businesses that have come up through, you know, the university network, or into businesses as graduates and developed, and are extremely capable business people, and that's starting to happen, and we're all much the better for it.
I agree indeed. Fantastic. So Willie, I see now, although you've always had an interest in the bus and coach sector, which of course is where I come from, you've got more and more business in that area now, I see.
Yeah, so we've always been limited in our ability to grow the business on the balance sheet, just due to, you know, scarcity of capital, etc. And so historically we bought the Forest Asset Finance business in 2016, but we've always funded most of that bus and coach business on a brokerage basis with large funders. Since being acquired by Arbuthnot, two and a half years ago, we've pretty much got unlimited liquidity now. So I'm really pleased that in the last year, we've significantly grown that bus and coach business on our balance sheet. And in actual fact, this year, we'll probably write some £200 million worth of bus and coach, as well as commercial vehicles. So by the end of this year, our business will be very equally split between commercial vehicles and bus and coach. And of course, talking about electricity, you know, we've just done the first swap over of batteries in our buses at 7 years. So we've had one customer that we funded buses that were electrics in TFL 7 years ago, and successfully just swapped the batteries, and we're refunding them over another 7 years. So there's a lot of learning from that sector to come into our commercial vehicles as well.
No, for sure. And the batteries that are coming out, getting repurposed for non-automotive, I guess, somewhere?
We're putting new batteries in, and they're being repurposed for alternative use. I'm not allowed to tell you where. That was a very strict NDA, but we're brand new batteries in, new warranties on the batteries, which is even better than the first ones, and the existing ones have been sold.
And so I guess that means the batteries that you've put in 7 years after the original ones are better, lighter, and have more energy density. And they're probably the last batteries those vehicles will have, because they'll last a little bit longer and their performance characteristics will hang on a bit longer as well.
Yeah, the current expectation is that we'll be able to sell those buses either UK domestically or export them, which we do quite a lot of, with a meaningful life left in the battery, some 30% life.
Willie, thank you very much. Look, that's been hugely enjoyable. And I know from my audience base and what they tell me, they're always delighted to know what the top people in various parts of the industries are thinking about what the future will be, because in the same way we're guessing about the future, so are they. So I know they'll find that hugely valuable. So my guest today has been Willie Patterson, who's the Chief Executive of Asset Alliance Group. We've been talking today here on Lunch with Leon, which is produced in conjunction with Passenger Transport Magazine. Please do go across to assetalliancegroup.co.uk for full details of the work that Willie and his team are doing, and in particular, the one I reference, which is the industry market report for 2023, which is available. Please come and join me again at Lunch with Leon. We'll have another exciting episode for you again very soon. But in the meantime, my great thanks to Willie Patterson for joining us today. Willie, thanks for being there.
Thank you, Liam. Really enjoyed the chat.